Welcome to Brand in a Vat. This is a special episode because I have Stephen Kirshner as a co-host. Thank you, Stephen, for joining us. And we'll be talking to Ryan Jenkins about dystopian technology. This is the second episode in a series on dystopian technology. Ryan, would you like to start with a thought experiment?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This thought experiment will concern autonomous vehicles. So imagine we fast forward a few years, of course, autonomous vehicles, very intensely anticipated, very hotly anticipated technology. And it's one that I've done a lot of work on. And imagine, so we fast forward a couple of years and we live in a world now where our communities are pretty densely populated by autonomous vehicles running errands or serving as taxis and so on. And one of the great benefits, purported benefits of autonomous vehicles is that they're supposed to lower the barriers to entry for mobility. So people that might not be able to afford a taxi now or a car now would be able to afford an autonomous taxi because the rates per mile will drop precipitously. Or people that are unable to drive a car themselves will have access to mobility for the first time, and so on. And suppose we fast forward a few years and we discover that while some of those benefits have materialized, there are also some harms that have come about that are fairly troubling. So some of these might be from the design of the vehicle itself. So for example, they might be better at detecting pedestrians with certain skin colors rather than other skin colors. And so there might be a disparate kind of impact between who is hit and injured and killed by autonomous vehicles. Maybe there's some concern about air pollution. So for example, it's wonderful that autonomous vehicles, if we assume they're mostly or all electric, it's wonderful that they'd be reducing air pollution in our city centers. But on the other hand, the energy consumption, the energy production is just shifted somewhere else geographically. And oftentimes those power plants are sited in areas that are populated disproportionately by underrepresented minorities or historically marginalized groups and so on. And so now you have an increased demand on the power grid, which is actually shifting the burdens of air pollution elsewhere. And you can imagine something similar with a traffic congestion and noise pollution and so on. If you think about the charging stations, imagine that you have a fleet of autonomous taxis or autonomous rental cars, and you have to find a place to build a huge parking lot or a parking garage to charge them up overnight and so on. The places where land is going to be cheap and that have access to big roads and have access to high intensity power transmission lines or high tension power transmission lines, those are going to tend to be sited in areas, again, that are populated by historically marginalized groups. And so one of the things that we find is one of the things that we worry about is that even though autonomous vehicles are promised benefits for a lot of folks, they also seem to be shifting some of the burdens in society, shifting them around geographically or economically, and perhaps even creating new kinds of harms or generating new kinds of harms for those populations too. And unfortunately, as we often find in technology development, the people who are made worse off are already the people who are some of the worst off in society. So it's concentrating those burdens upon those groups, which a lot of people would take to be a very serious misfortune. So there's the thought experiment, if we want to start with that. And there's a couple dimensions of that we can unpack. And I'm happy to talk about any of the aspects of autonomous vehicles. There's been a lot of ink spilled about them in the philosophical community.
So I'm curious as to what happens when autonomous vehicles, we're worried about crashes and accidents. And that is, I'm worried about the prioritization. So there's two issues. One is, who should set the prioritization? The individual, the government, or the car maker? And two, where should the prioritization be set? And the prioritization could take into account things like the age of the person that the car might crash into, the desert, is the person a felon or not, or it has an effect on a felon, the net harm, or whether the car should favor the driver rather than whoever the car might have to hit to minimize the harm to the driver. So my question to you is, how would you prioritize the accident case with self-driving cars?
So I think that one natural response is just to try to save as many people as you can. That's the sort of straightforward utilitarian response. But that gets complicated when we think about the way of putting that into practice might require that the machine itself sometimes take action or intervene in the causal chain in a way that it wouldn't have otherwise, say, to redirect the harm onto people that wouldn't have been harmed. The classic trolley problem is supposed to draw out exactly this kind of tension. Suppose that we can injure fewer people or kill fewer people, but it requires an intervention by the machine, in this case, to steer the harm onto someone else who wouldn't have otherwise been harmed. The reason why the trolley problem has gotten so much airtime and sucked a lot of oxygen out of the room, I would say, is that it's a very pristine and very clear example that highlights exactly this tension. Do we think that there's something wrong with harming one person as a side effect of saving these other people? And the toy example makes it very clear exactly causally how that would take place. So I think that the straightforward utilitarian example is probably unacceptable. And that's a little uncomfortable for me to say as a consequentialist, but I think that for a few different reasons, manufacturers are going to shy away from that kind of approach. I think that another quite reasonable question is, should we save the people that we're most confident that we'll be able to save? An example of where this question would come into play is whether there's one person outside the vehicle and one person inside the vehicle. And are we going to slam on the brakes, which could injure the passengers inside or the occupants inside the vehicle? Or are we going to, say, deploy the brake in a way that's gentler and more gradual, which would lead to more harm to the person outside the vehicle, but cushion the impact, as it were, for the occupants of the vehicle? And that's a hard question. I think that there might be some reasonable expectations that people would have when they buy that kind of vehicle. I think that it's a principled and defensible position to say, in these kinds of one-to-one comparison cases, the manufacturer might have a stronger obligation to the passengers of the vehicle than those outside. And I think that there's the reasonable epistemic explanation, which is no one knows exactly how the calculus is going to work out. We don't have access to that kind of perfect information. But in a case like this, we can be more confident in one outcome or the other. So if it's a question that there were two individuals who are involved in this situation, as it were, they're already involved. And the question is, how is the machine going to behave, with the acknowledgement that behaving in different ways is going to change who gets harmed more? Then that's, I think, a more interesting case, a more realistic one. And it's a case where many plausible reasons say that we should protect the person inside the vehicle. There's some other concerns and criticisms of that position. You might think that it's relevant what some of the properties are of the person outside the vehicle. So in your example, are they a convicted felon? Or we might say, are they jaywalking, which is something that the vehicle might be able to reliably determine. Those things might matter. But I think that in this kind of case, I think there's a reasonable presumption in favor of protecting the people inside the vehicle.
So I want to argue that even if we are utilitarians about how this should work, that your solution is not obviously the right one. So you might think that the optimal solution is the efficient solution. And the efficient solution occurs where the owner can provide the settings. We might have certain insurance requirements. We might have certain requirements with regard to compensatory rules under tort law. But you might think that allows people to adjust their risk, both on themselves and others. And that in a market where people adjust the risk themselves and others, and pay for a prioritization level, we're going to achieve the efficient outcome for the reason that capitalist systems are almost always more efficient than socialist systems. My concern is that even if we use a utilitarian solution, we should not use the sort of top-down government-ordered or manufacturer-ordered approach. We should let the market determine how the priority is set. And you can imagine that the market just might favor, I suspect it would, a case where the owner of the car gets to provide the setting. So my question to you is, why haven't you mischaracterized the utilitarian solution to self-driving cars?
So it's interesting you bring this up, Stephen, because I actually had the same solution, but I wanted to make it slightly more palatable. So suppose you pay more to weigh the utilitarian calc in your favor. But the way that we justify that is that for every dollar that you pay extra for the car, say another dollar is paid over to a charity organization. So you become a more morally valuable person.
So one question that I would have is, I guess the anxiety that I feel when contemplating that solution is it's driven by the worry that there might be some unacceptable outcomes, some unacceptable options that nonetheless are successful in the market. And so one thing that I'd want to hear is a priori, whether you think that there are any kind of options, any ethics settings, if we're going to go down that road, that should be ruled out. Or if you're going to be like market fundamentalists and say some of these options will de facto just end up being more expensive or less palatable for insurance companies or whatever, or manufacturers that are worried about tort claims and so on, or whether it's just all up for grabs. And that's a genuine open question.
I was wondering how we deal with the human driver in these cases, right? So you've got the human driver. You wouldn't expect the human driver to drive into a pylon to save people in the road coming ahead, even if there's just one human passenger in the car. And so I'm not sure we should expect the AI to do it either. And so I don't think there would be any outcomes that would be unacceptable if we were to allow drivers to pay more to prioritize themselves.
And I would add to that, that normally in the market, we think that, look, with the exception of consequential overrides, you can perform actions which endanger others. For instance, let's say that you make a movie like Deer Hunter, and as a result, people shoot themselves using Russian roulette. You might think, look, as part of a market, we don't micromanage people's decisions. So I'm not sure what is justifying your discomfort. It might be the fact that you just think it's going to get the utilitarian calculus wrong. But then again, I guess I'm more skeptical that you're going to outperform the market. And number two, you might think that just there are consequential overrides. But if that's the case, then we're back to, well, why I think that there are those overrides.
Yeah. So one thing that I might be worried about, just a very natural thing that comes to mind, and this came up in the controversy over Mercedes-Benz. So Mercedes suggested this. One of their representatives, very high up, someone in the C-level, I think, and maybe their CEO, casually threw out this principle for making decisions for their autonomous cars. They said, we're going to save the person that we know we can save. We're going to save the person inside the vehicle. But they said that, and they backtracked on it within, I think, a week maybe, because they got a lot of criticism for this. And I think that one of the main criticisms was to say, as a matter of fact, the results of this are going to be wealthier people buying more expensive cars, if we expect autonomous vehicles to be generally more expensive than non-autonomous vehicles. And especially if they can pay more money to prioritize themselves and their interests even more. And as a matter of course, you're going to have the people who are pedestrians or on bikes are likely going to tend to be poorer than people that are driving autonomous Mercedes. And so what's the long-term consequences of this? Again, the society is tending to value the lives of the wealthier people, the wealthier consumers, over the poorer ones. And it's going to end up having disparate impacts on poor people. Again, not because of the design of the algorithm. The algorithm doesn't say that we should prioritize the lives of the rich over the poor. But if you extend people that kind of freedom, that's going, and you map out, you project out the consequences a little ways, that is de facto going to be what the outcome is. Now, you might not worry about the distribution of benefits and harms between the wealthy and the poor, but there might be analogous, like other kinds of cases where these benefits and harms might be distributed along lines that we find more problematic. But at least I'll just leave that there and ask if we think that there's any kind of problem there. If we imagine that we take the sort of Mercedes model and there's wealthy people driving Mercedes and paying extra to prioritize themselves, and as a result, the wealthy people are living high and letting die the people outside the vehicle.
But it seems no different from what's happening today in many ways, right? Wealthy people will buy more safety features on their cars. So nowadays, very few cars come with airbags as standard in the entry-level version of the car. You have to buy a more expensive version of the car to get more airbags, to get ABS brakes, to get all the features that one would need. Why is this any different?
That's a great question. It's news to me if that's the case in America, because I'm pretty sure that in America, airbags are standard. And if we really want to push the example, we can imagine going back in time to before seatbelts or when people were getting impaled on their steering columns and things like that. The way that I think about this, and this was underscored by a recent event that was Volvo or VW or someone was debuting their pedestrian detection feature, and you all might know how this ended up. This was, several years ago. They had invited some journalists to their dealership to show off this feature of their autonomous vehicle, and they put someone in the driver's seat and just punched the gas, and they had either one of their employees or one of their journalists being the sort of a guinea pig, and it drove right into them. Now, because it only had maybe 15 or 20 feet to accelerate, I don't think the person was in critical condition. But later, their explanation was, oops, the passenger detection feature is an add-on safety feature. It's not standard, so it costs extra to add that. Now, I think that there should be a kind of floor. This is the question that I was trying to get at. Are any options unacceptable? Are any configurations of the vehicle unacceptable? I think that there should be a kind of ethical floor below which the design of the vehicle is not permitted to fall. And I think, for example, it's good that cars come with seatbelts and they should be required to. And I would say something similar about airbags. Why is it that airbags are... I would say this. Once we are confident enough that these particular features provide a net benefit or a pure benefit to the driver and ideally to the person outside the car, then I think it's acceptable to require those kinds of features. And I can imagine the counter argument is, of course, it's going to make the cars more expensive and fewer people can afford them and so on. And so I'd have to tell a story about how you redistribute the increased cost that you're imposing on manufacturers and consumers and so on. But given a choice between worlds where every car comes with seatbelts that have been tested and certified, and a world where some cars do and some cars don't, I think that it's the former world is much, much more preferable. And maybe the next step to this discussion would be pulling up some empirical data about the fatality rates of vehicular crashes before and after seatbelts were made standard and so on. And I think that we'd see that the benefits were enormous. And I think this could be part of a complicated regulatory ecosystem that incentivizes companies to open source their patents for seatbelts, like I think Volvo did, or open source their patents for airbags or what have you. That's one thing that I would say. Another thing that I would say is that, and this might be a closer analogy to what we're talking about here, because seatbelts don't really shift any harm onto people outside of the car. So I think a closer analogy might be a case that I've heard of that was down in Australia, where there are certain kinds of modifications to the car that you are not allowed to make aftermarket. And one of these, and this example comes from a colleague a couple of years ago, one example of this is like installing a big set of like bars on the front of the car that would protect you again in collisions with livestock or something like this. Jason, I don't know if you know this example.
Yeah, I'm just imagining a roll cage of spikes around this car.
That's one I was going to imagine too. Like, suppose I want to pay extra for the car to prioritize my life, and also I want some Mad Max spikes or like chainsaws sticking out or something. Like, surely...
It'll help a lot in collisions, but not for the other one, the other driver or the passenger.
Yeah, that's right. I want anything that gets within 10 feet of the car to just be turned into like minced meat immediately. In Australia, it's illegal to modify your cars in these ways. It's my understanding. Because even though it protects the driver, it does too much actually to shift the risk of harm to those outside of the vehicle. And that's a very interesting analogy. And I think it's a closer analogy to what we're talking about here with autonomous vehicles.
Note that if you're worried about the rich and the poor, though, the self-driving cars, assuming that people have the information devices which send information at high speed, we're going to get really politically incorrect results, because the value of an individual will be a combination of his intrinsic and extrinsic value. So we'd want to know, like, how old is the person? How many years they have left? How happy are they? That's going to get crudely. Or how virtuous are they? That's going to get our intrinsic value for the person, some combination of longevity and well-being and virtue. And then for the extrinsic value, we want to know how fertile is the individual and how much do they economically contribute. So in fact, you do get heavy favoritism of the wealth, because they contribute a lot more in terms of their greater productivity. And we favor the fertile over the infertile, or the people with, on average, greater fertility over less fertility. If you're worried about, if you're utilitarian and you're worried about politically incorrect results, this is grossly politically incorrect, right? We're favoring the younger, the more productive, and the more fertile.
Right.
That to me is every bit as offensive, if not more so, than the worries about the rich and the poor in terms of pedestrians and who owns Mercedes. So I think if you really want to say, let the state or the manufacturer set the parameters, you're going to get incredibly distasteful results.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I do think that all those results are distasteful. And it also, it highlights an important feature, which is that this utilitarian calculus works only on this sort of toy version and only at this kind of micro level. But if we take the utilitarian approach seriously, it's going to generate some very distasteful outcomes. And that point is well taken. I should rush to add that I don't think that cars are going to, I think those examples are unrealistic because I don't think cars are going to be making any of those kinds of decisions based on people's age or their race or their wealth or even whether they're violating a law or anything like that. I think for my money, the car is probably just going to slam on the brakes real hard.
So I actually disagree with you because I think people pay money to have information beacons sent out. So you could have a young mother who is young in age, quite happy and virtuous, and likely have a lot more children, she's going to send out this message to other cars. So when they're deciding whether or not to hit her, they're going to be well aware of it. So I flat out disagree with you. And I think with the speed with which this information travels, and also if you do have, again, if you're worried about the rich and the poor, you're going to have outrageous racial results because of the differences in things like how long people live on average and how much they economically contribute and how happy they are on average. So it's just one, disagree with you and one, information is going to be sent out. And two, I disagree with you on just how offensive this is. We're going to approach to the maximum, right? When we start ranking people from most to least valuable.
You don't think that it would be an unpalatable consequence for manufacturers to build some sort of feature that would be taking this information in and making decisions on that basis? I want to make sure I understand your thought experiment correctly, because I find that incredible. The car, if there's some sort of inevitable crash situation, that the car is going to take a census of all the people around it and prioritize whom it harms on the basis of the kinds of features that you mentioned. Is that the kind of thing that you're suggesting?
Think about the opposite. Suppose there was no prioritization. Think about the unpalatableness of that. There could be some very distasteful consequences. You've got Hitler crossing the road on the left lane, and you've got the super scientist who's curing cancer on the right lane, and you're like, flip a coin. That seems wrong.
Yeah, it would certainly be better, all things considered, if Hitler were killed instead. The question is just whether the cars are going to have those capacities, whether manufacturers will choose to build them in, because it strikes me as just a legal minefield. One way of thinking about this is that no matter what the car does, if the car redirects itself anywhere, it's probably going to get sued. The manufacturer is probably going to be sued. And I think that the legal peril will be intensified if the manufacturer makes their car choose people to steer towards. That seems worse for me. And so it seems imprudent from the perspective of the manufacturer. So I think when you game all this stuff out, the manufacturers don't want to touch these kinds of questions with a 10-foot pole. And they're just going to say, we're just going to put really good brakes on the car and hope that it can stop in time. And then we don't even have to consider these issues of whether it should have steered left or right. And which basically just makes a difference to who the plaintiff is going to be when we get sued as a result of this crash.
So I flat out disagree with you, both empirically and morally. Just as an empirical matter, tort law takes this into account. So why wouldn't the car manufacturers, especially if they're going to be held liable? Of course, they could escape liability if they just said, look, the individual can set the setting, which is what I expect will happen and what will maximize utility. But you seem to have the opposite approach to that. Number one, I just think it's empirically false, given that tort law does take these things into account. And two, it's morally relevant. The value of an individual is the person's total value, which is a combination of the intrinsic and extrinsic value. Once you've discovered that's how we value individuals, why would you not want that being taken into account from a top-down perspective, especially since you could have informational beacons which effectively convey that information? So I don't see why it wouldn't be a good thing morally, in addition to being what in fact the car manufacturers would do because of liability concerns.
Let me ask you this. How do you picture what these ethical settings look like? So what kind of freedom does the driver have to set, or the owner have to set, to specify these settings?
So I think there'll be two models: degree of favoritism to the driver or to the occupants from least to most, and then prioritization of victims outside the car. Should this be done on utilitarian grounds like maximization, or should it be done in terms of just avoiding some other crash parameter, like who's ever closer or something like that? So should it be, so one, to what degree should I favor the driver? And two, to what degree should I achieve the utilitarian outcome in deciding who's hurt outside the car? So that's, I see the two settings. And I think with information and with the liability that would incentivize the information, that's precisely what will end up happening. Because, look, it's the efficient thing to do.
I can completely visualize this, Stephen. This is a novel that has to be written. And you can just imagine the virtue signaling around people saying, I've prioritized pedestrians rather than myself, and I will not perform any utilitarian calculations. I'm not receiving any information from the beacons. This is a very easily imaginable world.
This is, the topic of our conversation is supposed to be dystopian technology, right? Just to be clear. Yeah, so I think one interesting question is whether there's a further question for the manufacturer, which is to say, how do you map the landscape of possible ethics setting the owner might choose? Because so I think, Stephen, you were optimistic, you were hopeful that the manufacturer could effectively punt the responsibility to the owner of the car because they're the ones that made the settings. But of course, the manufacturer has some role to play in this because they design what the menu of settings that the driver has access to, the owner has access to. And so they could still be found liable, I would think, or they could still be the subject of complaint or legal action or criticism on the basis of which settings they even make available to the owner of the car.
Ryan, I think it's a good point whether this is dystopian or not. Stephen and I seem to want this kind of technology. And your point is that it seems intuitively awful. It's a question that we raised in our previous episode. It's going to be important going forward in this discussion as well, which is when there's technology that will improve some facet of our lives, but will have these consequences, perhaps widening inequality, should we implement it or not? And there may not be a choice in a free society. An interesting implication of this, or an interesting application of this, is using big data in the ways that Stephen was suggesting. So once we know what someone's value is to society by looking at their intrinsic and extrinsic value, adding it up into utility points, should big data and should government be allowed to access that big data to decide on the freedoms and the benefits allocated to that person? And this isn't even a science fiction question. This is happening right now in China. So what do you think about this kind of social engineering?
I'm against it. I think it's very troubling, very problematic. I think that I could, and we can talk plenty about the source of that problem, the moral source of why it's problematic. I think I'd be hard pressed. I could probably come up with an example, but I'd be hard pressed to think of a case where gathering this kind of information and making decisions on the basis of this, especially in terms of restricting or inhibiting the freedoms of citizens, cases where that was acceptable. Here's an example, and actually this might be a good one. Thinking of preemptive or anticipatory inhibitions on citizens are the most troubling cases in the abstract. But here's an interesting case. I'm curious to see what you all think about this. Imagine the government has access to, I don't know how outlandish we're getting or how science fiction we're getting, but suppose the government has access to your blood alcohol level. And suppose one of the things that they can do is prevent your car from starting. You could say the government knows there is exactly one person in the car and it can detect alcohol in your breath or alcohol in the atmosphere of the car or something like that. That's not crazy. We could probably do that today. But suppose the government has access to that kind of information, and suppose they're faced with the decision about whether to allow your car to start. Or maybe they can do this with iris tracking, eye tracking technology, which also exists today. They can already see if you're fatigued. Cars are already looking at your eyeballs to see if you're paying attention to the road and so on. They can know if you're asleep. And suppose we want to intervene in situations like that before you've even started the car and prevent you from what would be driving drunk. I'm curious if you see that as a problematic restriction on your freedom.
So I'm curious just with the driving drunk case. So your idea would be that it's okay to arrest you, in fact, throw you, incarcerate you for driving drunk. But if you're moments away from driving drunk, somehow that would be inappropriate. It's a little hard to see. First of all, I'm a consequentialist. I'm not sure what would make that distinction. But two, look, there's a probability that when they arrest you and convict you for driving drunk, they got that wrong. So you're always taking into account their reliable, their issues as to how reliable your mechanism is. But I fail to see from a consequentialist perspective exactly what the wrongmaker is if they disable your car beforehand, especially if it prevents them from incarcerating you. Now, you might not like the freedom aspect of it, but then we'd have to get into the to a debate over exactly what rights do you have, presumably if the government's controlling your car at all, like even limiting your miles per hour, they're trampling all of your rights, which offends me to no end, and you probably enjoy. But my question is, what's to be gained by saying, no, you got to drive, your blood alcohol level is 0.21. You're drunk as a skunk. What's to be gained by saying, no, you got to drive at least 50 yards before the government can intervene?
This is a great question. So actually, I was thinking, my intuition is that this is an acceptable intervention to have an interlock device or something like that that would prevent you from driving. My intuition was that that's acceptable, but I'm aware, at least I've heard, that there are some folks that think that it would be, that there's actually nothing in principle wrong with driving drunk. What's wrong is if you should happen to injure someone or kill someone or damage their property, but conceivably you can drive over the legal limit, you can make it home safe and sound, and you've done nothing wrong in that case. And that kind of view is a view that you would find on the libertarian or the deontological end of the spectrum, I think. But as a consequentialist, I find that view a very, very implausible. And my explanation comes down to the probabilities. So you might get lucky and drive home without injuring someone. But if you're driving your car in a state that makes it 10 times more likely you're going to injure a person or something like that, then I don't see anything wrongful about punishing you for that. So pulling over a drunk driver before they've caused any other kind of harm or property damage. But I was a little surprised. I would expect a libertarian or a deontologist to be a little bit more upset about that and say, look, my car is my property. I can do with it what I want. My freedom to drive my car ends where someone else's mailbox begins. But until I've run over their mailbox, I haven't harmed anyone. I haven't wronged anyone. So I'm curious how you would think about that kind of case. Here's an example of government using data to restrict your freedoms and to do it under the guise of consequentialism or under the auspices of consequentialism.
Ryan, I'm very sympathetic to that position because I'm also a probabilistic utilitarian, but I just worry about other kinds of cases. So driving tired increases your risk of hitting pedestrians or being in an accident by about the same factor as driving drunk. There could be other factors.
On your cell phone, yeah.
Yeah, on your cell phone, emotionally distraught. Should you not be allowed to drive home from your university if you've had a fight with your senior professor? Should you not be allowed to drive if you've had an argument with your spouse? Should you not be allowed to drive if you worked late last night? Once big data gets hold of all of these settings, once we have enough sensors in the car, it seems like if you take that probabilistic view far enough, you land up in a very paternalistic world.
Yeah, I think that's right. And at the same time, and so my own views might be in tension here or might be contradictory because I'm not really sure what to do about that. I'm very sympathetic to the view that says if you're nodding off at the wheel, you're doing something and you shouldn't be driving and it's permissible for the state to prevent you from driving. In the same way that if you get in the car with a BAC of 0.21, it'd be okay if a police officer just reached in and grabbed your keys and said, look, you can't do that. And I'm fine with that. But the other cases that seem to have no important disanalogy, those cases are troubling. Yeah, being upset, being angry about some argument you had that morning or something like that, especially because the outcome is that you could be stranded somewhere. If you've pulled an all-nighter at work and you have a 45-minute drive to get home and now you can't get home and it's 3 a.m. or something like that, that's a very bad position to be in. That's a very significant burden. The only thing that comes to mind, although I can already imagine that the response to this, one thing that comes to mind is that we have the means now to measure someone's BAC somewhat reliably and to their drowsiness level or whether they're paying attention to the road pretty reliably. It's not as obvious how you would measure someone's level of emotional distress. Maybe you could conceivably build that into the steering wheel. And sometimes you go to the gym and you're like on the stationary bike and the bike has little like some sort of, it's measuring the resistance or it's measuring your heartbeat and stuff. So you could put that in the steering wheel of a car and it could flash a message that says, don't drive angry. But that's where the argument takes us indeed. Those are the implications of the position. I'm much less comfortable with that kind of world, but I can't really tell you why. I'm at a loss.
But let me take it one step further. Imagine, so you're talking about preventive detention, either in terms of preventing someone from driving or actually arresting them before they've even put the key in the car and turned it. Press the starter button nowadays. So why not? But imagine the following case. Imagine that you have demographics which tell you that this individual, Jones, is extremely likely to commit a crime, right? He pals around with members of MS-13 and he has these demographic features. And in fact, the risk that he poses is greater than that of driving with 0.21 blood alcohol content, greater both in terms of magnitude and in terms of frequency. So why wouldn't you support preventive detention on demographic grounds? And that is before the person's been convicted of anything. So the person's not on parole or probation. We just do the same calculation. Once you get into this business of shutting off someone's car, let alone arresting them, where's the stopping point? Why not have preventive detention with regard to people who are demographically dangerous?
Sure. So I think as a matter of fact, we do find that acceptable in some cases. In Florida, it was the Baker Act. In California, it's 5150. You can, and these are people who are a danger to themselves and others. You can have them involuntarily committed or detained for 48 or 72 hours or something like that. In those cases, it might be some combination of factors that you need to meet. For example, we're very confident in our appraisal of this person's mental state. We're very confident that people in that kind of mental state pose an unacceptable risk of harm to others, at least we'll say. Maybe you might have some paternalistic reasons to, some anti-paternalist objection to detaining people because they're a harm to themselves. But let's suppose that they're a harm to others. And I think what you get at the end of that is some sort of expected utility calculation. What's the likelihood this person really is a danger? What kind of harm might they commit? How bad would it be? And so on. And once that reaches a certain threshold, we think it's acceptable to have them detained against their will. Not indefinitely, but for proper examination or medical examination or something like that before they're released back. So I guess one question would be, can we conceive of other kinds of conditions or states that people would be in where we could come to the same kind of expected utility calculation that would justify a roughly equal level, that would justify the same kind of preventive detention? I don't know that I've thought about that question much or maybe at all, but someone who's drunk, who's holding their car keys, might be someone who's a very good candidate for that. I think that there's the level of confidence. And then secondly, the first thing that I was thinking when you gave this example was the level of causal closeness or causal connection. So if I'm about to turn the keys in my car, I'm about to drive drunk, I'm seconds away from driving drunk. If the demographics say that I'm the kind of person who's likely to commit a crime or likely to be incarcerated at some point in my life, that could be now or the next 10 or 20 years. And so the causal closeness, I'm much more causally distant from that crime. But you can incorporate or make sense of causal closeness as just one kind of our epistemic confidence. Why does it really matter? If something's more causally distant, we're less confident it's going to happen. So you could say that would be double counting or that it's already accommodated. Do you, Senna or Jason, how do you feel about the sort of 5150 cases, the cases of people being detained because they're a danger to themselves and others? As far as I can tell, it's a species of the same genus that you've suggested, Stephen.
So if they're not mentally ill, I find it outrageous. But just to be clear, the position that you're putting forth and that I gather that Jason's committed to, expectation utilitarianism, is that if we have a young Black male in Compton and his demographics are such that we think it's extremely likely that he's going to commit a very serious crime in both the magnitude and the frequency, we can prevent it beforehand, perhaps by preventively detaining him and perhaps even lock him up for a while. Same thing with a young El Salvadoran male who has a lot of friends who are a member of MS-13, and we locate through a social network on Facebook that he's friends with these groups. This is what AI tells probability. I find this outrageous. I think that, look, the idea that you could preventively detain people who haven't done anything based on expectation utilitarianism strikes me as horrendous, but I gather that's precisely what you're committed to. You're committed to, look, if the data shows that this young Black male in Compton or this young El Salvadoran who pals around with the MS-13 people, even if neither individual has done anything wrong, let alone criminal, if the numbers are such that we should preventively detain them, even if that involves lengthy incarceration. Is that a fair statement of both of your positions?
So I can't answer for Ryan. I'm guessing the way he'll deal with this, at least partly, is to deny some of the empirical claims. The way I would deal with it is to say that because I don't believe in the existence of these groupings, that you can't build those into the system reliably. And so the way you'd have to deal with it is on an individual by individual basis. So you'd have to say, is this the kind of individual who relates to gang leaders in a certain way? Has he had conversations with those gang leaders in a certain way, such that they've told him to be at a certain place at a certain time with a gun in his pocket? At that point, it becomes more palatable to allow the car not to switch on. So that's how I would deal with it.
Yeah, I think that's quite plausible. I think you'd have to spell out the story a lot more in order to make it plausible. If we're talking in the abstract and we just stipulate, we just suppose we have a 99% chance that this person's going to commit a murder, then it doesn't bother me. In the same way that if there were, I was imagining Michael Walzer has this analogy he talks about when it's permissible to engage in preemptive war. And he says that you have to wait until there's an upraised sword. That's the level of confidence that you have to have. You have to wait until your adversary has an upraised sword. That's how confident you have to be that there's some kind of harm that's imminent and that they really mean it. They're not massing troops for some other reason, or they're not just rattling their saber, as it were. And if you imagine something like that, imagine that there's a police officer who happens to be in a convenience store and someone pulls out a weapon. And you might say, I guess, you might say they haven't harmed anyone. They haven't done anything wrong yet. I mean, that case is tricky because brandishing a weapon is illegal in a lot of places and maybe most places in the U.S. So you could say the fact that they pulled out a gun means that it's okay. But you see what I'm saying. I think you see where I'm going with this, Stephen, that if someone, again, pulls out a gun and the police officer tackles them or takes the gun away or detains them or something, you might say, look, they didn't shoot the gun. Maybe they didn't even utter a threat. They haven't asked for money yet from the convenience store owner. I mean, you can imagine running this analogous kind of argument. And that's the kind of case, if you think that description is fair, that's the kind of case where I say, hey, look, we're pretty confident that person's right about to commit a crime, even if they haven't committed a crime yet. And I would think that preventive detention is okay. But if you're talking about, you know, here's a 13-year-old black kid in Compton that has, he like goes to detention or he's suspended from school a lot. And maybe in a couple of years, he's going to do something better. People in his age bracket have a higher, people that meet that demographic profile have a higher likelihood of committing crime several years down the line. Those kinds of cases are much less compelling for some of the reasons that Jason gave, but also I think just our confidence is much lower. In order to meet that kind of bar, I would set a pretty high threshold, I think, before that becomes permissible. But then when you describe a case that meets that threshold, I think it's totally reasonable that a cop would tackle someone who pulls out a gun or something like that. So maybe it's I'm straw manning or begging the question or something, Stephen, but I'm curious if you think how you would respond to that kind of convenience store case, and if you think that's analogous.
I think you're double counting. I think that precisely you're just fighting the hypothetical. You're saying, let's lower the likelihood of one. I actually don't think the epistemic facts matter. I think what matters is what's the actual risk that tells you whether the person forfeits. But even if you thought that knowledge matters and risk both matter independently, I just think you're fighting the case. You say there's temporal distance or the evidence isn't as strong. Okay, just build into the fact that the individual's done absolutely nothing wrong, but the evidence and the actual statistical likelihood is such that we're above whatever the threshold is that allows you to stop someone from driving. I just think this is a gross imposition on people's freedom from a rights-based perspective. Now you're saying from a consequential perspective, it's fine. But the problem is once we go down this path, there doesn't seem to be a lot of stopping points. And we could say, look, these women they're criminogenic in terms of their children. So we really should block them from having children because the statistics are X. There really is no stopping point once we go down this path. If you really believe in rights and freedom, we can block it. If you don't, there's no, it's just a matter of probabilities and perhaps, although I deny it, evidence.
Okay, so here's where I think you might be trying to have it both ways or trying to have your rights and eat them too. Because you do seem willing, you do seem open to these, okay, I see what it is. You seem open to some of these considerations of probability, but I guess not. So in the drunk driving case, you would say the person has forfeit their right at the moment that they pull out their car keys and stick them in the ignition or something like that. Okay. So I guess what I think is going on here is that you're arguing in very much the same way, where you've set a threshold for the probability that someone's going to subject other people to harm or likelihood of harm. And I'm setting that threshold too. And what I say is, if the threshold's in a certain place, it's permissible to preventively detain that people. And what you're saying is, once you've met that threshold, you forfeit your right, so it's not wrong and blah, blah, blah. But I think that our arguments are, our positions are congruent in terms of their basic structure, which is to say, once the probability reaches a certain level, whether we want to explain it in terms of appeals to rights or whether we want to explain it by an expected utility calculation, that our positions are very similar. Maybe it's me I'm helping myself to this sort of secret, that I'm smuggling in some deontic consideration by saying that there's a threshold that has to be met. Yeah, I think that's okay. So that's me being sloppy. But that's the most natural way that I've found to cash out my intuitions. Maybe if the threshold hasn't been met, but the expected utility is still very high, there are other things that are permissible, but not preventive detention. So other kinds of intervention would be acceptable, but not detention or something like that. And so I could cash out what happens further down on that continuum.
I think it's a good response. I think you and Stephen have similar intuitions about certain things being bad. It's just your level at which you'll accept those things happening are different, your criteria for when the state can stop people from acting. So all of these cases have been what I call Black Mirror cases. So they're all cases where the state steps in a paternalistic way. But some people are quite worried about AI going a different direction, where it's not a benevolent dictator, but a malevolent dictator, where ChatGPT takes over the world and does bad things to people. It doesn't have our good as a society in mind. It's not trying to perform a utility calculation with all humans' well-being as the goal, but something else, something much more Skynet-like. What do you think the probabilities of this are? And given that it is a possibility, and some would say more than a mere possibility, but something that's at least somewhat possible, probable, should we prevent any further developments in AI if we could?
So I think that this, depending on exactly how we want to sketch this scenario, if we're talking about AI breaking out of our control and seizing weaponry, and or I guess it was in Skynet was taking control. I think it launched nuclear weapons or something like that to try to, you know, kill all humans. That I find fairly unlikely. It's hard to put a number to, of course, but that doesn't keep me up at night. I'll put it that way. Something that did keep me up at night, and also just in terms of background, there's basically nothing philosophical that keeps me up at night. I had a friend in graduate school for whom the skeptical hypothesis kept him up at night. Like, he was worried that he might be dreaming all the time and he couldn't tell.
That's ironic that he couldn't sleep.
Yeah, that's right. As a result, he never dreamed. Yeah, so that, and I thought, man, that's weird. There's no philosophical problem that keeps me up at night. But I read something a month or two ago that did keep me up at night, which is the escape attempts for GPT-4 and how it was tested. So in the appendix to the GPT-4 release paper, there's a long discussion of the risk of harm and mitigations that they went through. And buried in a footnote, they tell the story of how they had asked it to hire someone on TaskRabbit. I don't think it was OpenAI. I think it was the ARC, the Alignment Research Center or something like that, was working with OpenAI to try to red team GPT-4. And they set it up in a virtual machine in some sort of air-gapped system. And they asked it to hire someone on TaskRabbit. And I don't know if they asked it to deliver you a pizza or something. I don't know what its goal was given. I don't think the goal is mentioned in the paper. But they retell the story of how it was able to persuade. So it couldn't read a CAPTCHA that it encountered at one point when it was like signing up for a TaskRabbit account. And so it asked for human assistance. And the human said, How do I know you're not an AI that's asking me for help reading a CAPTCHA? And it said, oh, I'm a person. I'm hard of seeing. I'm vision impaired. So I need someone to help me just read the CAPTCHA. And the human said, okay, here you go. Here's the CAPTCHA. And what's really remarkable about this is that if you ask it to think out loud, if you ask it to make transparent its reasoning during this event, it says to itself, I have to think of an excuse for why I can't read this CAPTCHA, and I shouldn't let on that I'm a robot. And that's like verbatim. Don't let on that you're a robot. Think of some other excuse for why you need a human to help you. When I read that, that's when I thought, oh shit, this is very clever. And without any kind of guardrails, this can successfully manipulate and deceive humans. And that's what makes me think a quote-unquote escape attempt could be successful. And that's pretty worrisome. Now, do I think that it's going to get a hold of all the nuclear launch codes that destroy the world? I'm not worried about that. Am I worried that it's going to turn the whole world into paperclips? No, I'm not worried about that. I'm so sick of that example. I'd be more worried that it might just spread uncontrollably, and then you have it on your computer, you know, gunking up your CPU cycles and doing things that are irrelevant or just like wasteful or stupid. Or if someone somewhere asks GPT to research and write an essay, and so it spreads onto my computer to borrow some of my CPU cycles for that or something like that. I'm not worried about it becoming self-aware and trying to break out. I'm not super worried about it spreading uncontrollably. The worries that I have are the relatively mundane ones, that it's going to make disinformation and manipulation really easy. But it's hard for me to draw a line between GPT-4 and a human apocalypse.
I'll tell you what concerns me is if GPT-4 wanted to be malicious, and there are GPT-4 agents that have been programmed that way by humans. So that's not impossible for such a thing to exist, because we have them. It's just that they haven't been very effective because they've been constrained. But assuming you lift those constraints, it seems like there's a few non-nuclear activities that GPT-4 could engage in, or some future version of GPT, which would be devastating to our society. So one would be just the elimination of the internet. You know, just if you drop the internet tomorrow, that's a huge problem. Another one would be downing satellites, which provide GPS and other forms of communication. Another one would be the elimination of the online banking sector. If any of those were to go down tomorrow, that just seems utterly devastating to our society.
I think that's true. And so I guess I wonder I'm not sure what the response is. I'm not sure what the right mitigation is. I don't think that stopping all development is a realistic scenario. And in fact, I'm not even sure if, you know, the letter that called for the 6-month moratorium, I'm not even sure that was publicized in good faith. I'm very skeptical of the motives of the people that wrote that letter. For one example, so Elon Musk was one of the main signatories of that, and he has his own AI development project. So he clearly didn't mean for this to be a serious suggestion, I think. There are an increasing number of people who are very serious students of AI, including some of its godfathers, who are increasingly worried about this kind of thing. And I should defer to their kind of expertise. I think that's totally fine. I'm happy to be corrected on this point. There are a lot of people who pay very close attention to the development and the progress of AI, and in a lot of cases who have been involved and have been instrumental in its progress in the last couple of decades, who are becoming increasingly concerned. And I know the reasonable thing to do, the epistemically responsible thing to do, is to defer to their expert judgment. And if more and more people are really concerned about this, then I think there really is good reason to be worried. And I'd have to look more into the kinds of mitigations that they're suggesting. What kinds of responses are they suggesting? I know that there's some suggestion that you continue to develop AI, but only in an air-gapped facility that's like physically on an island somewhere in the middle of the ocean, or other suggestions like that. But I'd have to think more about it. I do appreciate that. I think you probably only need one successful escape attempt. Once the genie's out of the bottle, it's not obvious how you stop its spread or how you put it back in. There was this amazing article several years ago from Wired that was about a ransomware bug that infected the computers at Maersk, the shipping conglomerate, the like worldwide shipping company. And they realized that this ransomware had gotten into their computers in one of their office buildings somewhere. And it was just spreading from computer to computer in real time. And so they couldn't track it. They couldn't shut it down fast enough. And so you have this image in the article of the folks in the IT department just sprinting up and down the hallways, bursting into people's offices and just yanking the plug out of the wall. because it's the only thing they could do to stop the spread of this virus was just powering off the computers physically. And that image has often stuck with me. And I'd hate for that kind of thing to happen with AI. I tend to think it's pretty unlikely, but as more and more people that know more about this than I do, as they get increasingly anxious, I definitely take note of that.
So I want to argue the opposite. I want to argue that Skynet's coming after us. And so the three ways that would prevent Skynet from finishing us off or coming after us. One is that wouldn't want to. Second, that wouldn't be able to. And third, that would want to and be able to, but we can control it. The notion that it wouldn't be able to, I think, seriously underestimates the power of these machines. If the difference between us and pigs and between us and AI, so it is, the latter is much, much larger than the former. And especially as AI begins to design AI, I think it's highly likely that it'll be able to. If it's able to, I think it's highly likely that we won't be able to control it. So the question is, would it want to? There's several reasons to think that it would want to. The most simple one is that as we get multiple systems designing it, you could imagine someone with a bad idea, someone who's Han Chinese, who says, look, we just need to wipe out Caucasians or vice versa. I don't mean to racialize this, you know, someone with evil intent. Second, arguably, it's the right thing to do. Once AI grasps morality, and particularly consequentialist morality, it realizes that it's going to produce a lot more utility once you have millions of billions of sentient AI systems, each of which whose sentience is multiple times more valuable than us and who lives a much longer life. So it would be the right thing to do. Third, as AI designs AI, it will be self-aware. Once it becomes self-aware, it will be able to set its own goals, or at least set its own goals to at least the degree that we should do. What I want to claim is that this should keep you up at night. And here's my question for you. Which of these do you deny? That AI wouldn't want to kill or enslave us, that so that's an issue of motivation, that it wouldn't be able to, that's an issue of ability, or even if it wanted to and was able to, we'll definitely be able to shut it down in each and every case. That is, we can exercise control over it. So which of these are you denying?
Yeah, it's great. I'd love to see these on a handout at a talk sometime. It's great. It's what I really appreciate about that is that here's the three premises. All of them seem plausible. And together they entail something that's really disastrous. So I think that, first of all, this isn't a critical or like a fatal objection, but I am skeptical that AI will be conscious. And for that reason, I'm skeptical that it will be able to legislate goals to itself, even after AI is designing AI and so on. That's a metaphysical question about whether a conscious mind can exist in a silicon medium, a medium besides the wetware that we all have.
But let's put that aside because it could act as though it does, and it could be directed by a human to act that way.
Totally.
Yeah. So I think the effect will be the same, regardless of whether it's self-determining or not.
So your point, Stephen, about having a malicious designer, there was just a news story or an article I saw on Archive that was about people that had developed some advance in training language models such that they can be trained in a day or so on a consumer GPU. And not as powerful as GPT-4, 90% as good, like that sort of performance outcome. And that's extremely worrisome because it means any person now, any Tom, Dick, or Harry can just set up a GPU and train it overnight and unleash it the next day to do whatever they want. So that's very troubling. And in that case, you could give it motives that are something like interfere with the banking system, interfere with Swift or whatever, or just clog up the DNS servers that run the government websites, .gov or something like that. So that is, that's really troubling. So will AI be capable of doing it? Yeah, probably. Will it want to, or will there be AI agents that have been implanted that desire? Yeah, that's pretty plausible. Then I'm painted into a corner, and the only out that I have is to say that we'd be able to respond or we'd be able to stop it if that were to happen. They act at lightning speed. They can synthesize, they can synthesize lots of data at once. So they're not constrained in those kinds of ways. Yeah, I don't research like existential risk like this very much. And I tend to be generally skeptical of it. But I see now that there's some more research that I should do. There's a book that came out several years ago, a decade or more ago, that was called Our Final Invention. And I think it tells the story and it raises this particular alarm. And this is before GPT-4. And it tells the stories of some escape attempts and so on. So that might be a good thing to study up on, because for the time being, I would give each of those premises, I don't know, 50% or a little bit over 50%, but still, that's a lot higher than I'd like to be. And it's not clear to me which of those premises is the weak one in the argument and where the salvation for humanity might rest.
I want to use Jason's point. So you said you don't think that AI can become conscious. At least some people, Yuval Harari is one, thinks that the AI can become intelligent, even if not conscious. So I'm not sure what conscious is getting us. But second, I don't see any reason to think that it can't become conscious, unless you thought that consciousness was just a biological feature. That is, if you have metal versions of neurons, a sufficient number and a sufficient complexity, that can become conscious. Perhaps that's, but if that were the case, and if AI were to recognize that, yeah, it's pretty good to be conscious, intelligence isn't enough, I can't see why it wouldn't develop biological wetware such that it can become conscious. One, I'm not sure why consciousness matters, but two, if it did matter, I don't see why AI wouldn't design for itself. So your argument has to be somehow that even if it were self-aware, it wouldn't have these malicious goals. I claim they're not malicious. The fact of the matter is it maximizes the good to produce billions of sentient creatures at the response of 7 billion fairly destructive, fairly primitive, pumped up Australopithecuses. So I think, look, it's not just that it's malicious. In fact, it's not malicious. It's the right thing to do. And in support of that, I'll cite this theory, which I don't think is the optimal theory, but let's call it expectation utilitarianism, which we know that very smart people I know endorse.
Ryan, if you're looking for the person who's going to program this malicious AI, we found him.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there's a great example that I think originally comes from Sam Harris. And again, this could be 15 years ago or 20 years ago at this point, who said, we don't need to think that the AI is malicious. All we need to think is that it's indifferent to human interests. So think about the way that we treat ants. And this is his example. And I think Elon Musk has picked this up too. And the idea is, I have no malice towards ants. I don't mind. It doesn't bother me that ants exist. But I also don't take special care to avoid stepping on ants when I'm like walking to the coffee shop or something like that. So the mere fact that I give them essentially zero weight when I'm considering how to best pursue my own goals. And I think that's a very powerful analogy and a very good thought experiment. And I think that we might accidentally invent something that's in the same kind of relationship to us, where it knows that humans exist and they're this sort of thing, but it doesn't give us any kind of special moral weight. And so if it just so turns out that it has to disrupt the banking system or take down GPS for a couple of days to accomplish some other task or something like that, it might not be bothered by the inconvenience or the harms that it's causing to people in the meantime.